From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Donald Trump, the last man standing. Bernie Sanders takes Indiana. A Navy SEAL is killed by ISIS. With his Indiana win Tuesday, Donald Trump turned his fire on Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton, and she fired back.
We're going after Hillary Clinton.
I think it's a risk. I think he is a loose cannon, and loose cannons tend to misfire.
The GOP scrambling to deal with its own de facto nominee. House Speaker Paul Ryan said he's not ready to support Donald Trump.
I'm just not ready to do that at this point. I'm not there right now. And I hope to, though, and I want to. But I think what is required is that we unify this party.
And President Obama had his last laughs at the final White House Correspondents' Dinner, jabbing at the madcap tone of this election year.
8 years ago, I said it was time to change the tone of our politics. In hindsight, I clearly should have been more specific.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with J. Newton Small of Time Magazine, John McCormick of the Weekly Standard, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Where are American politics headed here? With Donald Trump and the GOP, with Sanders and Clinton fighting on? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is J. Newton Small, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine. Jay, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
Also from Washington, John McCormick joins us, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. John McCormick, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jay, and John.
Let's just cast our mind back for just a moment to before the Indiana vote. It got so wild there at the end. This was Fox News on Tuesday, I guess while they were voting. Donald Trump alleging in the home stretch here that Ted Cruz's father was with John F. Kennedy's assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, shortly before the assassination of the president in 1963, citing a National Enquirer story. Here's Trump on the stump.
His father was with Lee Harvey Oswald prior to Oswald's being shot. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. What is this, right prior to his being shot? And nobody even brings it up. I mean, they don't even talk about that. That was reported, and nobody talks about it. But I think it's horrible.
On the path to the Republican nomination for the presidency, Ted Cruz just unloaded, called him a narcissistic, amoral, and more.
This man is a pathological liar. He doesn't know the difference between truth and lies. He lies practically every word that comes out of his mouth.
And he won big in Indiana. John McCormick, how do you interpret that victory?
Well, it's a victory that means Donald Trump is the presumptive nominee. That doesn't change the fact that he is a mentally unstable conspiracy theorist with an authoritarian streak, as I write in the Weekly Standard this week. So conservatives like me are not going to be able to vote for him, and neither will we be able to vote for Hillary Clinton. I write that she's a habitual liar who would appoint Supreme Court justices who would trample on the Constitution. So conservatives like me are quite depressed, quite despondent, but we hope that there will be a third-party candidate, someone of principle, who we can vote for, and if not, I will write someone in.
Third party. We'll look at that. J. Newton Small, what do you make of Trump's big win in Indiana? I mean, this was supposed to be Ted Cruz's big comeback state, and instead he got pretty well trounced.
Yeah, indeed. Ted Cruz spent much of the week ahead of time really doing everything he could to try to win every news cycle to prevent the inevitability of Donald Trump, whether it was picking Carly Fiorina as his running mate or all kinds of almost, really could argue, stunts. But it's clear that he just has the momentum. Donald Trump has the voters with him on the Republican primary side, and he became unstoppable. And after Indiana, it was apparent to both Ted Cruz and John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, who was also still in the race, that Trump had it sewn up, and both just, I mean, it dropped out, and it was abrupt. I'm amazed that we actually, who would have thunk that we would have wrapped up the Republican primary before the Democratic primary this year?
Who would have thunk it? So much for the contested convention. Cruz out. Here was Kasich on Wednesday saying that he had renewed faith, deeper faith, and we're all listening for the traditional, you know, that the United States will go on and be great. No, it wasn't about the USA as Trump was taking it. Here was Kasich suspending his campaign.
As I suspend my campaign today, I have renewed faith, deeper faith, that the Lord will show me the way forward and fulfill the purpose of my life.
Jack Beatty, it's not renewed faith, deeper faith in the United States of America. He's like headed off to the desert to find the point of his life.
Thomas Merton moment there for him.
Yes,
you know, throughout this campaign, Governor Kasich has really marched to a different drummer, and he's been the only one who's heard that drummer. I mean, he was running fourth in a two-man race. That is, Marco Rubio, who was out of the race, was running ahead of him. Yeah, this was a quixotic and finally sort of vanity campaign, I think. And it was impervious to evidence. And the verdict, the evidence in Indiana, was single digits for Mr. Kasich.
We heard then the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, said he's not ready to support Donald Trump. Now, the polls show at this point, and who knows in this campaign year, that Hillary Clinton would beat Trump in the general election, if that's what we come up to, and who knows. But if it were a Trump president and a Speaker Ryan, what would that look like, John McCormick?
You know, you have no idea. Obviously, they have very different views. The line from Ryan yesterday was that he wants a standard bearer who bears our standards. Ryan soon be talking more about ideological matters. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Ryan has staked his career on reforming entitlements in order to avert a debt crisis, which he genuinely believes will do grave damage to our country. Trump has run, you know, on a completely populist demagogic platform saying you can have our cake and eat it too. We don't need to, you know, we can balance the budget, have everything we want, do it really easily. We don't need to make any serious choices. So I think I don't know exactly what Paul Ryan's hoping for, if he's hoping to get some concessions on matters of policy, or maybe he's trying to save his House majority. I mean, I think that a lot of Republicans, the only way that they can win this election is if they can create distance and separation from Trump. That Trump at the top of the ticket simply means that everyone's going to go down. When Obama won by 7 points in 2008, Democrats had something like a 78-seat majority in the House of Representatives. Right now, Trump is losing to Hillary Clinton by 7 points, and despite the gerrymandering and the concentration of Democratic voter in urban congressional districts, you can't sustain a 7-point loss and keep the House majority. So I'm not quite sure what Paul Ryan's trying to do right there, but there could be a little bit of politics, a little bit of policy that he has in mind. I think that if Trump doesn't genuinely change, doesn't genuinely improve his behavior, it's going to be even more humiliating for Paul Ryan, though, if he just rolls over and endorses him in a couple months. So it's really going to be interesting to watch to see what Ryan does here.
I mean, Jay, Paul Ryan, as John says, he's had a big focus on entitlements and the debt. Trump this week saying, you know, maybe we don't have to cut back. He said if the economy is good, it's good. So you can't lose if you're spending. And he says, I would borrow knowing that if the economy crashed, you could make a deal. I mean, this is what Puerto Rico is in the middle of doing right now, Jay. Their economy is in big trouble. They've overborrowed, and they're trying to say to their lenders, take, you know, some sense on the dollar. This is the thing that the United States was never, ever, ever, ever supposed to do. And here's Trump saying, well, I mean, he sounds like a deal maker, like the businessman that he is, Jay.
Yeah, as President Obama joked at the White House Correspondents' Weekend dinner last weekend, you know, Donald Trump should take a whack at closing Guantanamo Bay because he's clearly very good at shutting down beachfront properties and making them go bankrupt. And that is essentially what, I mean, has happened to a lot of his Atlantic City properties, where he declared bankruptcy, dumped a lot of the debt into the system, and cut, you know, a lot of workers lost their wages, lost their pensions, their health care. And so this is something that he has done in the private sector, and I think he wants to apply the same sort of tactics to the public sector, which is mildly terrifying, I'm sure, to fiscal conservatives like Paul Ryan, who would abhor the idea of sort of borrowing to spend, and especially at a time when the deficit is already so massive. And keep in mind as well, you know, Paul Ryan isn't completely without sort of his own personal ambitions here. I mean, he is very much the front runner for the 2020 election, whomever it may be, whether even if it's a Donald Trump presidency or Hillary Clinton presidency, he certainly is the front runner for the Republican Party to take up that mantle. And it's very tricky for him because once you start to endorse, as it is for his vulnerable members, somebody like Donald Trump, you then have to answer for everything he says, and for fiscal conservatives, yeah, but for a lot of other issues. There's a lot of positions he holds that are very troubling.
Jack, if Americans wanted something different, I mean, here it is in Donald Trump. He was asked on CNBC whether the United States needed to pay its debts in full or whether it could negotiate a partial repayment. And he said, I would borrow, again, knowing that if the economy crashed, you could make a deal. I mean, this in the White House is a whole new, you want new? This is new, Jack.
It's new, and it's of a piece with his sort of insouciant attitude about America's responsibilities around the world, which is basically a kind of nationalistic isolationism. He would throw out the architecture of Pax Americana, basically, and say, we're going to make a deal. You either pay more, Europe, East Asia, for your defense, or we're out of here, or you can go nuclear. Of course, he could change that position overnight. To me, the big paradox with Mr. Trump, and the thing I don't quite understand about the psychology of his voters, is I have never seen a more inconstant politician. That is a larger waffler. Four or five positions on abortion within as many days, for example. And yet, again and again, just in today's Washington Post, you see his people saying, I like how firm he is. I like how he sticks to positions. And you think, wait a minute, folks, look at the record. This man is constant only in his inconstancy.
But is it? I don't know, John. Maybe it's not ultimately firm positions that people are looking for. Maybe they feel like we're up against it. We need somebody who can run and gun and, you know, twist and shout and get us out of this pickle.
Well, I certainly think that has a lot to do with it. It's more about the image that he projects rather than any particular policy. I agree with Jack's point. You know, I say that some people think that maybe we object to Donald Trump because he's not as conservative as we are, not as hawkish as we are in foreign policy. And what I write in the Weekly Standard is that Donald Trump really doesn't have anything could approach ideology. You know, he was for the Iraq War before he was against it. He supported U.S. intervention in Libya before he opposed it. He said back in September that we should stay out of the fight against ISIS. And then he said that we should bomb the heck out of them. Mm-hmm. I changed that quote.
Yep.
And then he said he'd deploy ground troops. So you really have no idea where he's going to go.
Maybe Americans are sick of ideology. It's put us in a big old gridlock for a long time. Maybe helped take us to war that people are not so crazy about now. But we're on new terrain here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Trump sweeps toward the nomination. Sanders takes Indiana. A Navy SEAL killed by ISIS. President Obama drinks the filtered water in Flint. Jay Newton Small is with us, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine, author of Broad Influence. John McCormick is here, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. Jack Beatty's here. And you can join us. What did you think? That this would be the guy, Trump, at the end of that long, long Republican parade of contenders? Are you like Paul Ryan, not ready to support Trump? Are you with him? Are you headed for the northern border? What does this likely nominee mean for the country, say about the country? What's it mean that Bernie Sanders is still chalking up wins this week in Indiana? John McCormick saying Republicans worried about their hold on the House and maybe more at a fundraiser in Arizona last month. A little tape here. Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona said that Trump as the GOP nominee could hurt him, long-serving senator out of Arizona, in his reelection run this year. This audio obtained by Politico this week. It's a little rough to hear, but you get the idea. Here's McCain in Arizona.
Have no doubt that if it is Donald Trump at the top of the ticket here in Arizona, with over 30% of the vote being Hispanic vote, I have no doubt that this may be the race of my life. People are angry. They're upset. They feel that there's this disconnect.
A lot of hand-wringing and more. John McCormick's headline, Unfit to Serve, and he's talking about Trump. But you might have heard this just today in Charleston, West Virginia, talking with NPR's Don Gagne there. Cindy Workman, a Republican, said Republican politicians need to get on board the Trump train.
I think they're a bunch of sissies and they need to put on their big boy panties and stay with the party or else get the hell out of it.
John McCormick, get your big boy panties on. Stay with the party or get the hell out. Who's going to own this party, John?
Getting out of it is exactly the idea that if the party wants to abandon all principle and appoint, elect or nominate a conspiracy theorist who is mentally unstable, they're free to do that. But we're not compelled to vote for someone who does not pass the commander-in-chief test. And as I said, you know, this has little to do with ideology. It's about the fact that, I mean, this is a guy who insults women. He mocks the disabled. He promotes conspiracy theories about everything. You know, he spit on POWs when he said of John McCain that he doesn't, he likes people that weren't captured. and that this is a guy who dodged the draft with bone spurs that never stopped him from playing sports in college. He later called avoiding venereal disease in the 1980s his personal Vietnam. He simply lacks the character and the temperament to be president. And the fact that I've never considered myself a party person. I've considered myself a conservative. And I can't vote for Hillary Clinton, but I can't vote for Donald Trump. And so that's where I'll stand.
Tell us how you really feel about him, John. No, I know you're writing in seriousness here, and we see that. Jack, for the Republic, what does this mean? You've got a lot of Americans who are saying, this is the guy we want. And you've got this kind of critique from John, who you may or may not agree with his ideology, his politics, but he's a serious observer of the American scene.
Well, it's a sobering moment. I just for all the reasons John just adduced, I can't fathom how Trump has prospered. I really don't have a clue. Now, conventional explanations are offered. There are alienated, dissatisfied white voters who are hurt by deindustrialization and foreign trade. And yet, if you look at the data, his vote has been higher by $20,000, $25,000. His voters earn higher than the national median. Not to say they're all wealthy, but they're by no means mostly poor. Yeah. That vote has gone to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, mostly. What really is worrying here is the kind of nationalistic, almost white identity politics here. You don't want to go to racism and these things. But nevertheless, when Lindsey Graham says, if we nominate Trump, we will get destroyed and we will deserve it, the "we will deserve it" part.
What do you think he means by that?
I don't know. I think he means that a party that would, nominate a racist, a misogynist, a xenophobe, somebody who would, hire God knows how many secret police to round up the aliens among us and force them across the who would ban a billion Muslims from coming to the country, throwing out the religious test in our Constitution and our laws. Could such a party deserve to win? It really raises serious moral questions. And I think what we hear in John is the sort of serious moral reflection of a Republican saying, we can't stomach this. Principle will not allow this. You hear it in Eric Erickson at Red State, a vibrant partisan who just is disgusted. You hear it in Lindsey Graham. Sure, there are going to be plenty of Republicans who will go over to Trump, but boy, you're going to hear lots and lots of conservatives and Republicans who just can't stomach that.
Maybe you just don't understand him, Jack. Donald Trump tweeted yesterday, "Happy Cinco de Mayo. The best taco bowls are made in Trump Tower Grill. I love Hispanics." Maybe you just missed that. But he did say this week that he thought he could unite much of the Republican Party. J. Newton Small, listen with us here. But here's Donald Trump on NBC's Today showing maybe not all.
I am confident that I can unite much of it. Some of it I don't want. I mean, there were statements made about me that those people can go away and maybe come back in 8 years after we serve two terms. But honestly, there are some people I really don't want.
What that means for the GOP, we'll see. Let me get one call and bring it all to you, Jay. Wes in Nashville, Tennessee. Wes, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm scared to death about the very real possibility of a Trump in the Situation Room with his finger on the nuclear launch button. As I understand it, we still have a surefire way to prevent Trump from winning the presidency, and that's to pressure the RNC to change their 1237 rule beforehand and then force a brokered convention. Nobody's talking about how the RNC could do this. Forget about trying to save the Republican Party. What about saving the United States of America from this monster? If there was ever a reason we don't have direct election of candidates, this is it.
Wes, I appreciate your call. J. Newton Small, there was so much talk about the rules, about all kinds of backflips that could be done in Cleveland at the Republican National Convention. Well, Wes says, hey, if he's got 1,237 votes, make it 1,238. Could there still be a rules answer to this, Jay?
That's highly, highly unlikely at this point. I mean, you see, despite the distaste for it, and it's noticeable that both former President Bush's are not going to go to the convention. Neither is John McCain. Neither is Mitt Romney. The only sort of former nominee, Republican nominee, who is going to go to the convention at this point is Bob Dole. It's striking that senators like Kelly Ayotte, who's running for re-election in New Hampshire as a Republican, has said she's not going to endorse Donald Trump. She's not going to work against him, but she's not going to support support him either. I mean, this is something where the party is really clearly split, but if you tried to hijack the entire convention and go against the will of millions and millions and millions of Republican voters, that is an even quicker way to assure a totally destroyed party, a party that would burn itself down. And Donald Trump has promised to incite riots in Cleveland and other places if that were to happen. So I just think, you know, the Republican Party, while not relishing and enjoying the idea of Donald Trump's candidacy as their sort of standard bearer going into this election, knows that depriving him of this nomination would be even more detrimental to their party.
John McCormick, what are you imagining for the convention and maybe well apart from the convention? I think I heard you say third party there. Are you and other conservatives serious about that at this point for this campaign season?
Certainly. I think that, you know, an ideal candidate would be somebody like Dr. Tom Coburn, who is a principal conservative who's now out of office. There are some deadlines coming up very quickly, but in 1980, John Anderson challenged those early deadlines, and the Supreme Court held that they were unconstitutional. I think that would be the case if someone stood up. I think there's the money there. There's the willpower there. To Jay's point earlier about whether they could, you know, change rules, I agree with her that there's just not the willpower to do it. But of the many essential causes for Trump's success, one of them is structural. The way that the Republicans designed their rules was to let a person with plurality support win the nomination. Mm-hmm. If the Republicans had Democratic rules, Donald Trump is getting 40% of the popular vote. He'd be getting 40% of the delegates, which means that the other 60% could vote for somebody else. But Republicans have different rules. They allow winner-take-all, someone who gets, you know, 37% of the vote. If the next best person got 36%, then that guy with 37% got all the delegates in that state. So it's really unfortunate. You know, with plurality candidates, often they can really energize a very energetic faction of the party,
yep.
not having consensus, and the getting majority is really key to getting a consensus figure. So I do think it's unfortunate that the Republicans wrote these rules in the first place. I don't think there's any will whatsoever to change the rules when they get to Cleveland, unless, I don't know, something. We've seen so many crazy things happen, but it would take something truly amazingly insane for the Republicans to change the rules and deny Donald Trump the nomination.
Winner take all sounds like a Trump philosophy, and he's certainly writing it very effectively. Chris in Esterville, Iowa. Chris, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, my comment is about the whole thing. We went back to that one gentleman that was talking about morals and personality.
Yes.
I want them to name a candidate we have right now that'll actually get into office and do what they say they're going to do. I've watched the elections here for the last 16 years, and they all say they're going to do one thing, but when they get in office, they turn around and do another.
So what do you think of Trump? What do you think of the rest of the field at this point, Chris?
Trump, I like his personality, but he's so wishy-washy on subjects. And then I like what Bernie Sanders brings to the table now, if he would actually stand up and do what he actually says he's going to do.
So Sanders for firmness, but are you going back and forth between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
But they've got such different kind of, you know, one's a billionaire, one's a socialist. Doesn't it seem like a pretty wide swing for you?
It really is, but I like how Bernie Sanders focuses more on the middle class than Trump does. I really haven't heard much what he's going to do to help out the lower classes and middle classes.
Yeah, Chris, we've got it. Boy, Jack, there it is, and that is interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, what's it going to be, Sanders or Trump? Well, I mean, he says he's a billionaire. Others dispute that, but still, he's no Bernie Sanders. And to make those two your kind of, I mean, I've heard this more often from callers in this season than I would ever have imagined. There's something really interesting there.
Yes, an impulse to shake up the whole system and to get, quote, authentic politicians. Well, Bernie is authentic. He's been saying the same things for 35 years without change. You know, polls show that only about 10 or maybe 12% of Sanders voters would consider voting for Trump. So it's not a
two-way street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And already Trump, to his credit as a politician, is tacking in the Sanders direction. Look what he said yesterday. He said, well, you know, I was against raising the minimum wage, but maybe I got to rethink that. People can't live on this. It sounds like Bernie Sanders. He's not going to go to $15. And then about his tax cut, he had a huge tax cut, most of which would go to the top earners. And he said, oh, man, I got to rethink that one. We got to help the middle class. So he's moving in the direction that Chris wants.
Maybe people want somebody who's always trying to suss out what some plurality anyway wants in the electorate. Robert in Clawson, South Carolina. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Okay. What do you see, Robert?
It's really simple. I'm an independent, and I've voted for both parties at every level in my adult life. We all know an imbecile like Trump, whether it's at work or in the Little League field or, sadly, a family member. I have an uncle that's on Trump's level. However, it takes him a few beers to get to that level before he starts fertilizing the air.
Okay.
Unfortunately, Trump's always there. Trump doesn't scare me. Trump is just another drunk uncle. What terrifies me is the level of ignorance of the American people and how it's floated to the surface and is getting ready to put this guy in office. There's really no explanation for it, but it's our sad reality. That's what terrifies me. I'm either going to drive to Mexico or Canada. There's nothing else to do.
Robert, I appreciate your call. Jay, I don't know what to do with that exactly, but it is an interesting year because it is, of course, part of the American way to always rapturously describe the electorate as this ultimate sort of wise arbiter of our fate. And this year, the commentariat is having some trouble with that.
It's been an amazingly fact-free campaign. I mean, just every time politicians and candidates this time around say anything, it's totally, most of it is completely untrue. And the press points it out constantly, and nobody seems to care. It's all about tone. And that's why you get people who wouldn't mind Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump, because to them, the tone is very much the same, even if the facts are completely different. And that is, you see this real impatience with Washington for the last 3 cycles. You've had Republican base voters, voting for Tea Party candidates who've promised to change Washington, to shake things up, to totally change everything. And they've been very disappointed that it's not possible, because Washington is not something that can turn on a dime. It's a system that our founders built as a checks and balances. And it's very hard to really do an enormous amount of change in Washington. Even if Donald Trump is elected, tons of studies show that there's, except for foreign policy and declaring war, there's very little he can do that would truly change the system.
Yeah, but Jay, let me ask you about that, because the Tea Party, whatever you think of what they accomplished or didn't, they were very ideologically strong. And if people are disappointed in that they didn't get that, now here's Trump, who's not ideologically strong at all. It drives John McCormick crazy, but you've got a lot of voters saying, take off the straitjacket, go for it, Donald, whatever.
They just want to see disruption. I mean, they want to see change that, in the ways that in all the other areas of our life, it's so easy to, our smartphones have completely disrupted the way we interact with banks, the way we interact with, our friends, our relatives. I mean, everything is changing so quickly in our lives. And we're in the middle of this sort of once in a 500-year revolution since like the Gutenberg press in terms of a leap ahead in technology. Mm-hmm. And they want to see the government react in the same way. But as Barack Obama often says, changing government is like turning an aircraft carrier. You can only do it in incremental degrees. And that is incredibly frustrating to a lot of these voters who want to see immediate change. They want to see, Donald Trump saying you're fired and like changing everything, or voting people off the island.
And Tom, if I may, just to Robert's point, he says the people are ignorant. Well, there's partly journalism is responsible. The Republican race is over, said a headline this week, and journalism lost. Frank Bruni has put it this way: familiarity in the media has bred surrender.
What's it mean?
Well, basically, it means that the television networks found out he was terrific for ratings. In fact, Les Moonves, the executive at CBS, said, he may be bad for the country, but boy, is he good for us. We put him on every time we get. And what kind of questioning have you got to him? Mr. Trump, now, when you build this wall, is it going to be 12 feet high or 13? you get into that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And let me give a mini example of the kind of bad press coverage. This is USA Today talking about his birtherism. Remember he said,
sure,
I'll send investigators to Hawaii to look into it. They write, he even sent investigators to Hawaii. They didn't say, he says he sent. They asserted it as a fact.
Yeah. And who knows?
Yeah.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, iced coffee controversy. A customer sues Starbucks over the ice in her cup. Oh, boy. Here's NBC's Tom Costello.
At issue, whether customers get more ice than drink when they order a venti iced coffee. The customer, Stacy Pincus in Chicago, is seeking $5 million in damages.
Okay, first world problems. English soccer upended when super dark horse Leicester City, against 5,000-1 odds, won its first Premier League championship.
Leicester City have fulfilled the most fantastical football fable in the history of English football. The fearless Foxes have won the title for the first time in their 132-year history.
Did he say the most fantastical football fable of the fearless Foxes? I think he did. And the Broadway smash hit Hamilton made history of its own with a record 16 Tony Award nominations.
Hey, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot.
We're looking at a week in the news. You can join us. How do you picture Trump versus Clinton playing out, if that's what it is? What about Bernie Sanders now? What does the Navy SEAL killed by ISIS in Iraq tell you about the U.S. combat role now? Is it time to clamp down on e-cigarettes? That's coming. And how'd you like Obama's last blast of correspondence dinner humor? With John McCormick, senior writer at the Weekly Standard, Jay Newton Small, Washington correspondent for Time magazine, and our own Jack Beatty, Bernie Sanders won, and won pretty convincingly in Indiana this week, told NPR's Steve Inskeep he's going to stay in the race until the last vote is counted.
Maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I think that the people of every state in this country, including the largest state in America, California, should have a right to cast their votes as to who they want to see as president of the United States and what kind of agenda they want the Democratic Party to have.
Oh, California, here comes Bernie Sanders. Sarah in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi, Sarah, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that as a 24-year-old covered in student debt, a member of the LGBT community, and a woman, I'm really glad to hear a little bit about Sanders today on your program. I've been feeling like the media covers it up a little bit. They've been insinuating that Hillary will be the Democratic nominee. And it's just been really nice to hear about it today. So thank you. I like hearing conservatives are considering voting for Sanders.
you like your guy in Iowa who can't be decide between Trump and Sanders. Sarah, we'll definitely look at it. I mean, it is more or different than an insinuation. I mean, people count the delegate count, and it does look like Hillary's got a pretty strong lock on this. And yet, Jay, here was this Sanders win this week, and we're not talking, you know, I don't know where we're not talking. We're talking in the middle of the Midwest. We're talking Indiana. What do you make of the fact that this late in the game, Hillary Clinton could not put Indiana to bed? Bernie Sanders took it and took it pretty convincingly.
You know, it speaks to, you know, how weak she is, frankly, as a candidate. And she's really struggled, particularly with young female voters, as your caller just, you know, was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really hard for her, I think. And she talks often about how she's not a natural politician. This doesn't come naturally to her. And that's evident on the campaign trail. You know, I spoke with a young voter in New Hampshire just before that primary. It was a young woman who talked about how if you think of going to a political event as going on a first date, and you go to a Bernie Sanders event and he sweeps you off your feet and it's, you know, revolution and you know, it's I'm starting a movement and free, you know, college and free healthcare. And then you go to a Hillary Clinton event, and it's like going on a date with an accountant who talks about like saving for college and, you know, and like, and paying your mortgage. And it's very important stuff, but it's really boring by comparison. And she's just not as inspirational as Bernie is. And especially with young voters, they don't like it. They want to be inspired. They want to be moved.
Mary in Newton, Massachusetts. Mary, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to make a comment. I heard sometime on NPR last week, PolitiFacts or Politico,
Okay. They
said that Hillary Clinton's statements were the most reliable, accurate, truthful, direct, honest. And yet you have a guest in there saying she's a chronic liar. We have people call in over. I listen to your program a lot, and I hear people call. She's not trustworthy. She's not trustworthy.
It comes up. It's true.
They did this to Governor Dukakis when they said, "Where's the beef?" They repeated it so many times that he lost credibility. I would like, on point, Jack, you, Tom, to investigate how really reliable these comments are. If she's been elected senator 8 years for New York, and she represented President Obama's presidency to the whole world,
yes,
how can this woman not be trustworthy? So I just resent the fact that nobody's really looking into this and saying, why do you not trust her? Where did she go wrong? I want to hear the details. I'm sorry, I'm hurrying, and I'm a little aggressive.
No, it's good, Mary, and I'm glad you raised it just that way. I mean, we'll pick it up right here. We'll pay attention to it throughout the campaign. But, Jack, what about it? Sometimes these memes get created, yeah, and they can have, you know, they can have some roots in the way someone has presented themselves in the world, but they can also be constructed. And certainly Hillary Clinton was, you know, early to say the great conspiracy idea. But is this, in the end, a kind of a durable smear that cannot be supported by the facts, Jack? This whole meme of inauthenticity or dishonesty?
Well, her campaign is wrestling, according to the news reports, with having her make a kind of John Kennedy speech on religion. You know, we talked about, yeah, his independence from the Vatican, and she needs to make one on her question of whether she's reliable, whether she's trustworthy. And
on
sort
what
of,
basis? Mary would say at that point.
Right.
What basis,
well, you know,
Jack Beatty? Do you repeat
I'm happy
that?
To chime in.
Well, you know, she talks about that PolitiFact poll, and Nick Kristof has written a very good column about it. They call it Debunking the Crooked Hillary Myth. He points to that poll, and he said that she has her facts have been true or accurate 95% of the time. Well, he had to correct that the next week. It's 50% of the time. Still, that's the highest of any other candidate, by higher than Sanders and way higher than Trump, who's down in single digits.
Oh, boy, 50% and you win. You sweep the field, okay.
You sweep the field. But the point is, that's a metric of reliability. And that metric, she's ahead of anybody else. She speaks the truth about policy more often than other candidates. And he goes to this business of the emails, and he says, you know, if you really look at all this, what's this about? She didn't want Republican politicians to be able to dig into her emails or, you know, she didn't want a kind of freedom of information suit to dig into her emails and find stuff to use against her. Well, that's not necessarily to her credit, but it's so far from, you know, her carelessness toward national security, her indifference to all the rest, and that's taken on legs. But Mary, I don't think, is being entirely honest with herself. I have seen Hillary as she has throughout her career, and there have just been moments again and again and again where she said things that were provably not so. From the, you know, cattle futures or whatever it was back in the 70s, how she earned $10,000 overnight on Wall Street, to you know, the missing records of the law firm that suddenly turned up, to the, you know, she was being shelled or shot at when she landed in Bosnia. She says things that aren't so, and she has. And so it isn't entirely made up of whole cloth that she has a credibility problem.
But at 50% is the tops in the field. You got to grant her 50%. John, I hear you chomping at the bit there.
Well, I'll just point out two things. One is, at a press conference, Hillary Clinton stood up and said that there was no classified information on her private email server. Here's a headline from the Washington Post. Clinton, on her private server, wrote 104 emails the government says are classified. A second point I'd make is in the aftermath of the Benghazi attack. She said that the campaign theme of the Obama re-election was that al-Qaeda was on the run, that they had been decimated. And so the line from the administration we heard was that this was just simply a riot. It's something from a video. It wasn't a pre-planned terrorist attack or anything. And she went to the family members of the Benghazi victims, and she said, "We are going to arrest the filmmaker who was responsible for your son's death." She lied. She knew. They knew that this was a pre-planned terrorist attack. They knew it. The record has shown that. And to promote this, I don't know if that's the reason why they did it, if it was because of politics, but she lied about a terrorist attack. She lied to a person serving the United States who died, his family. I think that really shows a level of moral turpitude there. And again, I had very strong words for Donald Trump either, but I'm not going to lay off Hillary Clinton either.
You know, I guess it depends who you frame how. You can go at a lot of politicians and look at what they've said in a particular circumstance. I mean, I hear Mary's frustration with hearing this one framing put on Hillary Clinton again and again and again when she's tops in the field, at least by PolitiFact, I guess, at 50% against all the others. Things been said about Donald Trump? A lot of things about Donald Trump, moral turpitude, maybe the least of them. And we are going to see plenty of that in this campaign. Going to be fascinating to see how it works both ways, if it's Trump versus Clinton. But Hillary Clinton already this week out with a video online criticizing Trump. And the criticism comes not from her, but from Trump's fellow Republicans.
The most vulgar person to ever aspire to the presidency.
The man who seems to only feel big when he's trying to make other people look small.
Don't worry about it, little Marco.
Gentlemen, the man is utterly amoral.
The sign of deep insecurity and weakness.
The bullying, the greed, the showing off.
I'm really rich.
The misogyny, the absurd third grade theatrics.
Count to ten, Donald. Count
up to 10.
He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot.
Okay, Jay Newton-Small, and we've barely begun the general election, but there's Hillary Clinton's camp putting out Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, Mitt Romney, Carly Fiorina, Marco Rubio, all lined up with this amazing cavalcade of tape that's been collected over the last year. This is going to be something else if it's this head-to-head, Jay.
Oh my! I think it's going to be the nastiest general election I think America's seen in quite a while, if ever. I mean, it's just going to be so unbelievably nasty. And already, I mean, not only is Hillary Clinton have huge amounts of ammunition against Donald Trump, but Donald Trump has also, you know, been pretty nasty right out of the gate with her, you know, saying she's playing the woman card, talking about her husband's affairs and invoking Bill Cosby. I mean, he promises to constantly bring this up and to talk about this throughout the election, and it's just going to be bathed in mud, kind of awful and terrible and nasty for the next 6 months, and it's going to be, I guess, interesting, if not totally revolting.
All this beginning to be really in the air this week. Wednesday, Hillary Clinton said on CNN that America cannot take the risk of electing Donald Trump.
He's a loose cannon. I mean, he's somebody who has said so many things, and I'm sure he'll be scrambling and his advisors will be scrambling, but he's already said all of these things. So you can go down a long list, some of which he's tried to bob and weave a little bit, but I think it's a risk. I think he is a loose cannon, and loose cannons tend to misfire.
John McCormick, loose cannon, it kind of echoes the tone of your column in the Weekly Standard, Unfit to Serve, talking about Donald Trump. Americans have historically not wanted a loose cannon in the White House. You're talking about a third party, but we know the history on third party candidacies, and it's pretty grim. At the end of the day, a choice has to be made here. Do you think many Republicans will actually just sit out, like the Bush family apparently, or go over and vote for Hillary Clinton, John?
Well, the polls show that, you know, Donald Trump wouldn't even win if he got 100% of Republicans right now. A CNN poll came out just this week showing that Hillary Clinton leads Donald Trump by 13 points nationally. At the same time, 84% of Republicans support Donald Trump. Only 12% support Hillary Clinton. So it's not simply a matter. I think that Donald Trump is toxic enough among independents that he'll manage to lose this thing anyway. But at the end of the day, you know, you just have to vote your principles. If you think two people are genuinely unqualified, you just have to stand there and you hope that it sends a message that next time things will turn out better. But again, you know, it's not just Hillary Clinton who's echoing my editorial. I'm echoing what Marco Rubio and Bobby Jindal said a couple months ago.
Sure.
They said that this guy was a lunatic who was unfit to have the nuclear codes of the United States of America. And I think they're humiliating themselves. They're debasing themselves. They're discrediting themselves to simply change their minds. Now, 2 months later, what's changed in the last couple months? He read a speech off of a teleprompter.
I mean, they're lining up with him now. Yeah.
They're lining up for Trump now. And if he was unfit to serve in March, when they were running against him, he didn't magically become fit to serve simply because he had won the Indiana primary and he read a foreign policy speech off a teleprompter. This is still the same conspiracy theorist, the same guy who is erratic and unstable. And if you truly believe that back in March, I don't see how you can change your mind in May.
And let me remind you, dear listeners, this is John McCormick speaking, senior writer at the Weekly Standard, one of the most prominent and conservative publications in America. Carlos in Austin, Texas, you're on the air. Carlos, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom, long-time listener. I appreciate you having me on. I'm going to try to cover a lot in a really short amount of time.
Okay.
So I'm actually a naturalized citizen who came over in the 80s with my parents. And I joined them. I served in the military. I was college educated. And frankly, I'm appalled and freaked out that Trump is inspiring an entire generation to oppress others, even natural-born Americans. And he's empowered by this racist uprising that is a result of betrayal by both sides of the aisle. A changing American demographic, a fear because a black guy took the presidency, and this combined with a horrific education system that is not creating talent for 21st century jobs, which is in fact being absorbed by an enormous number of H-1B visas, is seen as a factor in America's seemingly emerging twilight. And so what makes me sad is that we don't give a third option a chance. Maybe it's the media, maybe it's racism and blind anger, but to me, someone like Bernie Sanders, who, yes, is a despicable socialist by traditional America standards, is the only person who has called them out on their corruption and is offering some plan, any plan, to get us out of the Wall Street-driven rut that we're in. Because to me, the only way we're going to get out of things is by rebuilding our infrastructure. That is the way forward. And if we don't do it, we will be a third world country in a generation.
Carlos, we got to take it right there. You came with an inaugural address, Carlos, and we hear it, and I appreciate it. I mean, Jack, you know, Americans are thinking and thinking hard right now. Trump and everything else raises the heat under this whole situation.
Oh, yes, and gives everything an urgency it never had before, because such a demagogue has never been, you know, a crisis removed from being elected president, an economic downturn removed. But, you know, as to Bernie, I see and sympathize with what Carlos is saying. But, you know, look at the similarity between Bernie and Trump, not on factual, you know, on policy or anything, or even on character, a political character, but rather on promising impossibilities. You know, Huey Long once said, a politician is somebody who promises things that he can't fulfill, makes fake promises. Bernie cut, you know, his numbers don't even begin to add up about his Medicare for All. Liberal economists have documented that profusely. You know, his College for All proposal, well, would wind up with ordinary people paying for Donald Trump's kids to go to college. He talks about not just liberalizing immigration issues, but letting people who've been deported before come back to the country. These are impossible promises.
Jack, a whole generation is shaking their head right now and saying, come on, get with the revolution.
I
don't know. We'll see where it goes. What a week. American politics in a whole new gear. I want to thank all of my panelists today. John McCormick, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. Unfit to Serve is his piece in the current edition, and I guess we got that loud and clear. John, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jay Newton Small, Washington correspondent at Time Magazine, author of Broad Influence. Jay, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And Jack, as always, our thanks to you.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, sign up for our Week in the News email newsletter at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.